You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on From Embers, you'll hear my conversation with Jonathan Vallely and Eric Levitt of Gay for Pay Press, a zine distro largely focused on radical politics and queer men based out of Toronto and Ottawa. We talk about cruising, a world without police, community conversations around consent and accountability, crystal meth, and of course, zines. Enjoy!
My name is Jonathan Vallely. I'm one part of Gay for Pay Press, and I'm based in Toronto on Anishinaabe and Mississauga territory.
Yeah, I'm Eric. I am from Toronto, but I now live in Ottawa. I've lived there for 2 years. I'm also one half of Gay for Pay Press, but I'm also so much more.
You are.
Tell me a bit about Gay for Pay Press. How'd you get started, and what made you decide to start a zine distro in particular?
So Gay for Pay is our shared project as editors, or we often come up with fun titles for ourselves depending on the event. So like Head Fag Enabler, or like Copy Slut, or like whatever various things make sense in the moment. And we print and distro and sell a bunch of our own projects, which are like stuff we've written individually or together, but we also distro other folks' work and also edit some compilation stuff. And it's all within the loose container, or at least kind of began within the loose container of stuff affecting queer men, gay men, from a radical queer political stance. So that's everything from sexual health and well-being to like cruising politics to where do queer men fit into radical communities. And it sort of evolved along with our interests along the years. But Eric actually started it as a solo thing, so maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, so I started it, I don't know exactly how long ago I started it, but it was mostly just as like a quick way to contain some of the writing that I was doing and also distribute it. Also just not seeing a lot of like queer dude representation within the sort of like zine scene that I was in was like a big, not that it was bad, but just like that sort of was like, oh, I think I can add to this. 'Cause there was like a lot of interesting conversations, and I feel like there was a lot of perspectives that were provided, and I really appreciated and learned from those. But I also noticed that there was like a bit of a lack in terms of like queer dudes talking about queer dude stuff.
Yeah, I think we met at the first queer zine fair.
We did.
And like I was just handing out some of my like corny poetry zines like candy to anyone who would take them.
Yeah.
And Eric was like, wait, I think maybe we have shared interests. I had started making zines only a year or two previously, just like kind of inspired by some of the stuff I was encountering when I had moved to Toronto. I'm originally from Philly, like the historical queer core zines that are a big part of Toronto history, and then also some of the stuff my like friends were making. And then when Eric and I met, we decided to work together. But I think the big catalyst for like our shared values or vision, maybe, or one of them, was Consensus, which was a zine compiling a dozen or so different folks' experience about negotiating consent from the perspective of gay, queer, bi, man who has sex with men, whatever that spectrum is, which I think there was a bit of a blurry lacking of conversation about within the many amazing, awesome zines about consent that I was accessing, and I think that you were accessing, and like wanting to add to that conversation about some of those contextual complexities within cruising culture or within like queer men's cultures. And I think that is a good example of like not wanting to be like, we need to take up more space as men, which is the opposite of how I think we feel, but rather being like, these amazing nuanced conversations that are being had are ones we want to engage from our own experience.
Something that stood out to me is how like a lot of the models of consent that you explore in that piece don't necessarily fit with the ways that like laws and courts define consent, like whether that's because those situations are criminalized, like cruising, or just because they don't really map onto models of like contractual explicit consent. And I'm not sure like how much you were thinking about that when you were putting the zine together some years ago, but like in this moment when it feels like those state institutions are really trying to like shore up their legitimacy in dealing with sexual violence, or kind of assert that like that is like the proper avenue to deal with those situations or something.
So like I'll say I haven't really like revisited word for word that zine in a really long time, and I know there are things that I personally wrote in there that I would think about differently. But in general, cops, courts, and prisons don't do the thing they pretend to do, and instead just produce punishment and like harm, rather than, and like rarely actually respond to or address the like needs or possible paths forward that like make sense for people who have survived those things. But that said, there is a desire within my communities and within my relationships to be able to locate when interpersonal harm has been done through sexual assault and respond to it. And that conversation within and outside of the justice system is at a different place now than it was 7 years ago or whatever it was that we made that. So I think it would be really useful to return to that zine and see where what fits and what doesn't.
I think with that zine, which like, to be honest, at that point I was still like, zines are about the immediacy of production and not boring things like grammar. But then when I went on tour, I couldn't read. I couldn't read what I wrote. So I was like, I need to add some stuff to this. But like, from my perspective, it was more just about thinking of the ways that, the sort of special ways that we can navigate sexual space together that don't depend on, that don't depend on the ways that we've been at, like, I guess socialized to talk about them or something. I don't know if that makes any sense. And just trying to like reflect on that and put some words to it by being like, there is something really dynamic that we're doing, even if we're not talking about it. And so maybe just like starting from the point that that's really special and deserves some elaboration.
Well, I think like the tendency of cops and courts, whether by co-opting social justice movements, language and tools, or by like exploiting apparent cultural shifts or whatever it may be, is to criminalize more.
Yes.
Which rarely has the outcome of creating accountability on the ground. And so I think an example of that is the way that so much sexual assault happens in already criminalized contexts, as you mentioned. And so I two examples that I think bear out some of the complexities of this. Like, one is the most egregious sexual assault that I experienced was while I was escorting. And there was never a moment in my mind where I thought, like, going, and while I didn't have immigration status in Canada, and like, there was never a moment in my mind that I thought, like, going to the police or to the courts would help that at all. It just sounded like it would cost me a lot of money and like prevent me from accessing new clients and be really traumatic. And that was partially because of the criminalization of sex work, that is like blurry and ongoing. But another one would be with HIV non-disclosure. I'm not sure like how familiar you or like listeners or members are with the sort of like knot of non-disclosure in Canada. But like the short story is, Canada is the world leader in punishing, charging folks who are living with HIV for not disclosing their status to sexual partners, even if there's no transmission or no possibility of transmission, which often is charged under the aggravated sexual assault clause of the criminal code. And so even though there has like not been transmission of HIV or like other like harms that you would traditionally think of as sexual assault done, that is the clause, or like that is the framework used to criminalize and imprison people living with HIV who are like maybe people living in not safe situations with regards to disclosure, or like which statistically we know tend to affect women and newcomers and poor people. So the Liberal government most recently has said they are going to swap it out and make a new law in the criminal code that only criminalizes things when transmission has happened, but that now applies to any infectious disease, which again, like broadens the net of criminalization to sort of like, that could be anything really. We don't really know how that will play out.
Like, the police or whatever will like talk about how much they care about like queer people or whatever that actually means, but and like respect like the unique cultural practices of our community. But then at the same time, they'll, you know, perform like huge sting operations, like in Project Marie, for instance. I think it was 72 men or something that were charged. And so you can talk about how you want to be accountable, but then show time and time again, you actually won't. That you can take the language and divorce it from all the kinds of ways that we are accountable to each other. Like cruising, I think, can be massively very accountable. And
a lot of eyes.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, I remember when there was, I think you helped organize it, like the protest in the park, and people were talking about how that amount of men who were having sex with each other made the park at night safer for women. There was interesting ways that people felt like public space was for them when it might not have felt like that without that illegal behavior or whatever. And so I think that is something, when I think about like what we should do, I think we should explore that.
Just, I don't know if folks are familiar with Project Marie. It was this underground sting in Marie Curtis Park in Etobicoke and Mississauga, outside of Toronto, or like at the threshold where 21 Division, spent probably millions of dollars finding men who were cruising and then ticketing them. But one thing that came out of, and I was part of the resistance to that, which ended up forming this group, Queers Crash the Beat. But one thing that came out of that first protest in response to them was somebody asked like, well, what was enough for somebody to get ticketed? And the officer was like, well, this guy touched my chest as like sort of a come on, and that was enough for me to ticket them. And the person asking about this was like, well, like, men touch my chest all the time. This was like a person who passes as a woman. And they were like, men touch my chest all the time and touch me all the time and like cross my boundaries all the time. Like, are you planning on ticketing them? Like, are you expanding? Like, what is the scope of this? And of course the officers were like, oh, well, no, that's just like not feasible. But like protecting my own masculinity from being touched by these other men is worth
all going to your space.
Anyway, that has not so little to do with zines, but we just talked a lot about cruising and the cops.
You recently published a really beautiful zine called Queers Imagine a Future Without Police. That's like a series of questions and answers about what a world without police might look like, and how people would take care of ourselves and each other. And I noticed that that zine was written by members of Queers Crash the Beat in preparation for participation in Pride in 2018. Do you want to talk a bit more about Queers Crash the Beat?
Yeah, so Queers Crash the Beat, as I mentioned, formed sort of officially as a response to Toronto Police's sting operation in Marie Curtis Park. And it takes its name from the response protests or counter protests that we staged during their event called Walk the Beat with 21st Division, which was, and then colon, Take Back the Park, which was this sort of like weird candlelight parade where they like celebrated ousting queers from their park, I guess. So we like showed up and there were like 9,000 cops and about a dozen neighbor people there. They had a jet ski.
Yeah, it was really,
it was a lot. And then folks who, you know, helped organize that event and then who helped organize follow up from it, which in the end, I will say all of the charges got dropped for everyone who, was charged. We were able to get in contact with, so that was a cool victory, but also like a lawyerly victory. I think we also were able to use that moment in the ensuing months to open up conversations with folks who were sympathetic to our anger at the police around cruising and or around their cruising sting, and draw a bridge between that anger and like the organizing that was already being done for many years about abusive and violent police, especially towards Black folks in Toronto, towards people of color, towards poor people, drug users, sex workers. You know, there's always a long list, but those are folks who I deserve some credit for having done a lot of that organizing. There were folks who were sympathetic to our counter-protest around cruising who maybe weren't always intuitively making the connection to those other struggles that of course overlap and intersect. And so I think that became a bit of our project in the year that followed, was like having conversations with, I'll just say it, like sometimes like aggrieved older middle-class white guys who were pissed that cruising grounds were being like troubled by police, but maybe we're not necessarily as sympathetic or understanding around, for instance, the amazing queer folks at Black Lives Matter who were talking about like murders and violence against Black folks and Black bodies at the hands of police, and trying to draw that bridge. And it didn't always work, but sometimes it did. And then in the that sort of grew into those of us who kind of remained working on this stuff under that very vague umbrella of Queers Crash the Beat, a lot of us were like, okay, so how do we also sort of try to prompt these folks who are interested in engaging with us around one issue, who are trying to draw into a broader conversation about the state monopoly on violence and control and like coercive ways of enforcing that? How do we like take that conversation and now start opening up like what would it mean if there weren't such a thing as cops, courts, and prisons and a like coercive, violent, state run like set of do's and don'ts that can get you killed if you appear even to be on the side of don't, or if you happen to be affected in a particular way by historical systems of power, and that's sort of where the Imagine a World Without Police project came from. I kind of regret that, like, our beautiful banner, which was lavender.
God. It was so beautiful.
So our banner was made of lavender potassoie with mermaid sequins on it. It was really fabulous. And pink potassoie. And took a lot of work to make. That was what we ended up marching in the Trans March and Dyke March and Pride March in 2018, which was, I think, the year after the Black Lives Matter sit-in, and was a year where the police were not in the parade. We were like kind of waffled back and forth onto whether we wanted to do it or not. We kind of had to wheedle our way into the parade and did not want to give them any money. But in the end, it worked out. And it was just, again, to get that message out around like reaching folks who might be attending the Pride Parade who might not be engaging with us otherwise. And just even positing the question to them, like, what would it look like if we didn't have police here? So that was the big banner. And then we had these, like, sort of, my good girlfriend, my Kiki, designed them. And I thought it was a little ambitious, but they pulled off these, like, three-sided signs where one had a typical question about, well, what do we do with, like, you know, the murderers, or, like, who's going to protect us? And then on the other side's potential answers to those questions. So we did, like, those of us from Queers Crash the Beat who organized that bit of marching and pride did some group writing and brainstorming about what some of those common questions are, what some possible answers are, without being prescriptive, because I think answering those questions is, like, contextual and collaborative no matter what. But just positing a few possibilities. And then I ended up taking some of that writing we had done and wanting to capture it, which was really hard to read when we were, like, marching by on Yonge Street being like, less cops, more tops. And then, like, you can't read the weird sign that we're spinning. And we were probably all, like, f***ed up. I don't know. And so I wanted to capture that and elaborate that a little bit more. And so I made that zine, you know, with folks' permission, but there is no real clear author to it. I meant to mention, like, I wanted to say World Without Police rather than future, because I think a lot of folks have a trouble with the idea of, like, futurity, and also, like, want to start doing that work more immediately in this world. So that's my one kind of regret. But hey, the banner was a lot of work and I can't undo it. So, and the potassoie still looks good. So that was that zine, and Queers Crash the Beat is, like, pretty ragtag. And we kind of, like, those of us who are, we're not, like, a mass organizing unit. We're kind of just, like, a group of folks and kind of trust each other to do stuff under that moniker, which most of the time works out. But right now we're pretty dormant, though a lot of us continue to do work around police accountability and, like, trying to open up those dialogues.
F-A-G-G-O-T-O-G, you know me, Banji homie, only your homely, beat your makeup, your phony, get your cake up, your lonely, and I'm lovely, sipping bubbly, in a tubbly, with your hubby, suited and zit, who did it, bitch, I'm lucid and lit, shit. From the face, she's perched like a face, in case she won't break. Embraced by the state, the prize in their eyes, she's the house by the lake. Hey, supply life jacket. That's
Little touch, little touch, mess a cush. Little ass is a bag, I'm a puff. I'm a ghost, I'm a gag, I'm a goof. I'm a talk, I'm a tag, yeah, I took your man, homie, don't be mad, he was never your man, homie. Y'all fucked around, damn, homie, I let him out and he was just playing, homie. But I'm back, and that nigga can't live another cat, yeah. I'm a trap, and that nigga can't live another crack. So fuck what you thought, son, no sense of that.
A little while ago now, I came across the zine Where Are All the Gay Men in Radical Communities? And it's kind of, yeah, I mean, it was like pretty short and to the point. As folks who, I guess, participate in both gay and radical communities or social worlds or whatever, however overlapping those might be, what do you think are some things that folks in each of those worlds could learn from each other?
That is an incredible question. I think when I said, oh my God, I was like, I think the context of me writing that, which that's like a pretty old one, I think that was like a 50-minute rant. I think I was just like, where are we? And I think that we can offer so much, but also have so much to be accountable to, which is what I think, like, the question you're asking, which I think is really good. I think that one of the things that I really appreciate about gay, queer men's culture or whatever is we do have this, like, really political fagginess that I think is a little difficult to make sense of on the surface, but is actually, like, really meaningful and enjoyable and politically destabilizing. So, like, the way that I, like, described it, have described it before, is, like, to me, like, it's about taking very serious, like, the things that we have been told to take as very serious and making them very silly. And then at the same time, the things that we've been told to treat as very silly, we take them very seriously. So I call it, like, being silly with the serious and serious with the silly. And I think that there's something kind of like maybe camp would fit in with that. But I think that it's just like something really exciting that I think gay or queer dudes culture or whatever has this can do. And I love that. Mm. Like the obsession with like, I don't know, bad TV or like, and taking it so seriously. Or, like, yeah, I think that radical communities are important and do great work and act as homes for a lot of people, and that's really important, but they can also be a little serious at times, like a little too serious. And I think that some, like, really light, campy humor could be a really great antidote to keeping things really fresh and invigorating. And I think at the same time, this like political orientation when you're like always being really silly with serious things is deflationary. And I think that we sometimes need to be, as like queer dudes or whatever, need to be a little bit more reflective of like, is this the kind of thing that I can deflate right now and make a joke of? Or is this the thing that I should take really, that I should take seriously because someone's asking me to, or they're saying it's important that I do it. And at the same time, like, what might it be for radical spaces to be a little bit more campy, a little bit more fun and unpredictable? I think that's what I would say now. But really, when I wrote it, I was really like, I'm really horny. And I really want to love to meet lots of other queer dudes. Where are they?
Where are you?
Literally, where?
Well, I think that's the zine that you gave me at the Queer Zine Queer, and I read it, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, Eric. I'm right here. I'm right here. But not that that solved your horniness problem.
No, I'm a little embarrassed, but I'm also...
It's okay. Thanks. I think, so, a lot of, at the end of that, Queers Imagine a World Without Police scene, there's like, so what does this have to do with queer people? Like, there's all these questions about, like, what do we do? How do we, like, who's going to protect us? And what do we do about justice? And da da da. And then at the end, I try to bring it home and be like, queer people, not just gay men, but queer people and trans people have forever shown us how, like, creativity and creating our own spaces that can like sort of push back at or exist outside of normative or oppressive realities that we are in, like, can be fun and can be fab. And like, I think what you're saying about like also relaxing and not being so serious is part of it. And camp, whatever the f*** that means anymore. Like,
I don't know.
Ask Susan. can be a really useful tool. Humor is a useful tool. And that is by no means the exclusive insight of queer men.
Oh, no, definitely not.
Folks have that. But there is like a lineage there that I am like, you know, like sometimes when you're faced with a cop with some mace, you're like, what would Quentin Crisp do? You know? And I'm also blessed in that like, the ballroom scene, like the underground queer ballroom scene, is a strangely huge part of my life for being a white kid from suburban Philadelphia. But I have like really, really been so grateful to like have my skin a bit thickened by the sort of like level of like nonstop funny playful critique that people who call each other family in that scene lobby at each other in a way that's just like, you know, people love to talk about calling out and calling in. I feel like that sort of just like constantly reading each other ends up having like, can be harmful and hurtful sometimes, but also like creates a register of like mutual accountability, playfulness and support that also like prepares us for like the shittiness of the world that we encounter outside. It's like, well, if you think this is hard, girl, like there are other challenges where that like previously existing relationship or love or mutual accountability does not exist. So like we can kind of practice and hash out that kind of register of like critique in a way that is like somewhat safer. And sometimes it's totally not. Like people get fucking harmed and pissed off and go over and see it all the time. But like that is one unique queer like way of being playful with critique that I do think radical movements could learn from that I have in my queer cultures outside of it. Like so many cultures have their own formation of that that can inform radical cultures. That's just one that is, those are the ones that are close to my own experience and heart. So
I also wanted to ask you about the Letters to Meth zine project and I guess the Breaking the Ice project that was a larger part of.
So this was kind of not really a Gay for Pay project, but more a project that I was a part of, and the zine project was in particular something I led. So Letters to Meth is part of, as you mentioned, the broader Breaking the Ice project, which is on paper and is a one-year needs assessment driven by the 519 Community Center about how to better support people who use crystal meth especially queer and trans people who use crystal meth in the Church Wellesley Village, which is the historically queer neighborhood of Toronto, or one of them. And there was sort of, so I was a peer on the team, and as part of, so we did lots of like focus groups and interviews and policy stuff and whatever to sort of put together like your typical social services sector report around it. But there was also what was sort of initially called, and I guess it is still, an oral history aspect. I mean, the phrasing of oral history is not my particular cup of tea, but it's meaning like community stories and less sort of like research methodology from institutions and more collaborative art making and stuff like that. So I, of course, was like, I think the idea was like, well, this is a video with like some testimonials of people talking about crystal, which is like, first of all, fundamentally understands like the insane stigma that is attached to crystal meth, and like the fact that it's like you're immediately excluding a lot of people as soon as you get a camera rolling. But also like less interesting to me than starting with a different premise. So that's where the idea of having folks write letters to meth came from. And I, of course, wanted them to eventually become a zine. So the zine launched October 4th alongside some of the first outcomes or findings of the more formal report at the 519. And we had a wonderful marketplace with lots of like community agencies having like tables, some harm reduction kit making and naloxone distro, but also some local zinesters. Gay for Pay had an exceptionally large table since I had something to do with it. And I had also gotten a bunch of cool stuff to distro at the Anarchist Book Fair where you and I met. And so the launch was great, and the reception has been like pretty bananas. Like, people have been really excited about it. Lots of people asking for copies of the zine. We are also taking there's like a video accompaniment that is also a big physical installation that is huge and beautiful that is traveling to different sites around the city. And so right now it's at the Toronto Media Arts Centre as part of the Rendezvous with Madness Festival, which is put on by Workman Arts, which is an amazing organization that provides resources and space to folks with like various lived experiences as mental health consumers and psychiatric survivors. But yeah, the scene looks amazing. It's like a harm reduction bag with some foils in it, and it's a so beautiful glow in the dark crystal token.
I love it.
As well as the zine itself, which has a lot of letters and other cool imagery and quotes. So I'm really proud of it. And it's something that we're still sort of figuring out what the legacy will be. I think there are definitely a lot of folks who are like, when is it going online? Like, how do I see it? And for me as a zinester, I'm pretty tied to, and especially since it's part of a multidisciplinary piece, I'm pretty tied to like keeping it like at least that layout, like as a print thing that you access with your hands and eyes. But yeah, so like that's sort of where it came from. We did, in terms of how it was made, like anyone who participated in the focus groups or interviews were invited if they wanted to write a letter or create a letter. And we also did a few specific zine workshops like at the 519, but also in other spaces. So like I went out into the park with a lot of letters, like letter templates and blank pieces of paper to see if folks wanted to write them. We did some at Pieces to Pathways, which is a queer and trans youth like substance user or recovery service, I think is the best way to describe it, as well as with St. Stephen's Drop-In, which had a crystal meth specific programming for about a year called AMP, which was amazing. Shout out to them. Shout out to Richard at St. Stephen's, because we had all kinds of food and music and it was really fun and we made a lot of letters. So we had more than 100 people write a letter at some point. Not all of them made their way into the zine, but between the zine, the video, the installation, every letter is represented. And we are hoping to, in some form, make those letters accessible more broadly, like not just in zine form, but maybe as a slideshow or something online. People like are still terrified to talk about crystal meth. People It's like super demonized and stigmatized. Mm. It's also something that lots of people are, it's a substance that lots of people are using. And it's something that a lot of people, yes, in social services, but also in queer communities and in various other communities are confronting in new ways for the first time. And is sort of this interesting overlapping or simultaneous phenomenon with the overdose crisis, which has some really heroic activism happening that I've been, you know, party to and that I support. But that, like, also there is this other thing happening that doesn't, that isn't necessarily being seen or being accessed by quite as many people or in as immediate of a way. So, like, I think, but the veneer of, like, respectability guarding people from talking about opioids has been somewhat, like, compromised by the fact that so many people have, who, like, haven't had to confront substances in this or that way now are confronting them, like, has, is not necessarily the case with Crystal. Like, lots of folks use crystal, and a lot of people have a really hard time talking about it because it's so intensely stigmatized and brushed under the rug by, I think, some of the same sectors of society that have had to confront fentanyl and other opioids. Maybe I'll regret saying some of those things. but, like, I just think, like, they are, I understand why it's hard to talk about the two at the same time, and they're so, they're just different substances. Because
they're different.
They're really different. And yet people are encountering both in many spaces. And I'll say, like, Eric has done a lot of really incredible work in Ottawa and also personally around harm reduction, specifically with queer guys who use crystal, who party. And I've done a little bit of work around that issue here too. And it's something that has really kind of reshaped our distro a little bit. Like, if you look
it's gone real druggy.
Like, if you look at our table spread now versus what it looked like, I don't know, at the Hamilton, like, feminist zine fair 2013.
Yeah, oh,
it
my
looks
God.
Really what? Different. I know, that was the one where I debuted my like 13-year-old notebooks.
That's
where I
so
like
good.
Ranked the butts of the boys in my grade, but yeah. Like, no one wanted that there. But now it's like we have like harm reduction kits and naloxone and like lots of information about drugs and like using them in different ways that maybe are safer or that have different effects. And I think that just like aligns with both of our interests, but we both are particularly interested in like how are queer men doing when it comes to substances and like what can be done to like create more support, so more access to conversation.
Thank you. about boring life. It's really upside down. Looking for kinship, partaking in the fellowship of despair and sanity. Ecstasy turns tragedy as tentacles slowly jolt. As imaginary snipers aim from rooftops and SWAT teams drop to my windows, the glimmer of life finally makes its way through the staring.
You've been listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you might be listening to the podcast version online. In just a few moments, we'll get back to my interview with Eric Levitt and Jonathan Vallely of Gay for Pay Press. Just a heads up, we'll be jumping back in a little bit later in the interview at the tail end of a conversation about Grindr and other hookup apps, how cruising technologies have changed over the years, and the different ways people negotiate what kind of sex they'd like to have before they have it.
How can we imagine a world beyond prisons and police, borders and surveillance?
Rust Belt Abolition Radio is an abolitionist media and movement building project based in Detroit, Michigan.
Each monthly episode amplifies the voices of those impacted by mass incarceration and explores ongoing work in the movement to abolish the carceral state and racial capitalism.
Tune in to Rust Belt Abolition Radio here on the Channel Zero Network and visit www.rustbeltradio.org to learn more.
I think sometimes I think about the way that like all of our like public health and like, I don't know, I guess NGOs or something really individualize sex and sexuality. So it's always about like managing your individual risk. And we never talk about collective approaches to thinking through risk. And so the condom just becomes this, oh no, maybe I want this. Maybe I don't want this.
Yeah. I'm like, risk.
Well, maybe I don't know. I just think that like it would be interesting if we could like sustain some conversations about condoms and community care and pleasure that is not just so, yeah, pleasure, obviously. Like it's central to all of it. And also like focus on individual risk always like pushes pleasure out of the possibility of talking about, but like, What would it mean if we stopped thinking about our sex lives as purely just individual actions and start thinking about it as like this really, this conversation that's integral to healthy communities at the community level. Ooh. So it's not just individual like exchanges, but it's like, I don't know.
Relationality.
Yeah, something like that. And I always blame public health, but I think public health is really to blame for a lot of these fucking things.
I know, I'm like, I want to say the thing of like, well, let's like, can we decenter risk and center pleasure, but like neoliberal nonprofit industrial complex of like AIDS Inc.
Yeah.
Let me just shorten that to AIDS Inc. has totally like co-opted that to like do whatever the fuck they want.
But so. I also don't think that we should not talk about our health or the kinds of things that might not be good for our health. It's just the way that in particular, like risk is leveraged as the sole sort of thing we should be focused about. And then like pleasure just becomes the way in which we can talk about it. Like, it's just like the way that, well, that's how we're going to get people to, you know, sign on board to our workshops. Yeah, so we'll talk about pleasure, but like, it would be, I'm more curious about how we can hold, both as equally meaningful. Like, how do we, you know, not do the things that we don't want to do, or we can avoid the things that might hurt us. And we can also talk about all the kinds of exciting things that we want to do, and what might feel good, and hold that at the community level.
Right. A shared project.
Yeah. A shared project. Jonathan.
We're falling apart over here.
No, I mean, that kind of like collective understanding of sex at like, and of like myself as not just like one individual atomic decision maker or something, but like someone in relationship with many different people. I don't know. I guess I just like definitely appreciate thinking about it in those ways. Do you mostly table at zine fairs, or I guess I'm also like curious about how much you prioritize tabling at political events or like for other radicals or something, kind of like at the Toronto Book Fair, although there's definitely a lot of people from a lot of different worlds that came through. Yeah, how much would you do that versus like tabling at maybe less like explicitly political things?
Or just broader
interest? I mean, my thing is always, I'm just happy to be invited. So if you want me to come, like, I'll go.
Well, it's funny because like, I looked at the table that I had at the Anarchist Book Fair, and again at Kansas in Ottawa, and was like, holy shit, there's like so many zines here. Like, when did I print all of these? Like, the distro is a thing that really brought us together and is a shared project, but is like sometimes really accidental or incidental in terms of like how active we are. It's always flexible in terms of like capacity, like who's working on what, and like we don't have any money, but we normally like can take in enough to cover printing costs or whatever. So like I had such a great time at the Toronto Anarchist Book Fair, and then like a week later being in Ottawa, which is as you know, a really different space. And like, as the organizer of Kansas in Ottawa, I can say like a less explicitly political space, and that it's a catch-all zine fair. And like both are great, and we engage with so many interesting people in any given space. For instance, like a project like Letters to Meth, like I would love to get into the hands of people who use meth more than anyone else, really, as well as people who like love and know and support people who use meth, but like is interesting to all swaths of people, people who work in harm reduction, people who work in like social services, but also like people who just generally have radical politics around like deviance and substances. And like, I guess maybe I'm with Eric, where it's like wherever is we end up and wherever is we're invited and wherever it's convenient. Like, we also live in two different cities. We love any excuse to hang out with each other. I have tabled at the Paris Ass Book Fair in Paris, France, which was like a zine pal of mine through the mail organizes it and invited me. And it's like way more like fancy art books with like Tumblr pictures of like hipster guys' butts, and like nobody wanted to buy my zines. But I also felt like it was a good intervention to make in that space to be like, hi, reminder that you're like, boner is political right now, and like, would you like this free zine about it? And some, you know, to varied responses.
So I used to help organize the Toronto Queer Zine Fair, and I feel like that was took a lot of inspiration from like the Anarchist Book Fairs and stuff. For me, I always just thought that that's what zine fairs were. So I didn't really know that there was like a world of like fancy art book fairs necessarily.
Or comic fairs.
Or comics fairs.
And it's also like that's where we reach people. Like, we don't have a website.
Yeah.
We don't really. Yeah.
And it's not to say that like anyone is worse than the other, but I'm happy. Like, tabling is a really great thing. I really like talking to people, and I really like the fact that zines still serve this important political purpose. And as far as I'm concerned, like, Gay for Pay is nicely situated wherever you want to have us.
Yeah, we're invitable.
Very invitable.
But I mean, like, it's also like
eager even.
I've always said like especially starting with Consensus, but also with Clone Tide and Letters to Meth, and a lot of this stuff is like really personal for me that I don't want to be on the fucking internet. Sorry. And like, I don't really fuck with like the big social media surveillance culture. I don't really fuck with having my blog that no one ever reads. So like, there's something just containable or understandable or intelligible enough to me about the distribution network of handing somebody a zine over my table, or like having them walk by my table and drop a quarter into a jar and take the zine. Like, I don't know who you are or why you picked up the zine, but I like that distribution network more. It feels more intimate and it feels more like somehow trustworthy, even though it may not be. So like, I really like that ecosystem. I like that we don't have a web presence, even though I think it frustrates some people.
I was just wondering if there were a particular zines that you wanted to mention, either because you're super excited about it, or it's like a deep cut that you don't distro that often, or, and then also maybe let people know where the next place they can find you is, if that exists.
So I love my zine that's like my notebooks of erotica I wrote about my teachers when I was like 13, but it's just not everyone's cup of tea. It's more like, if you think that's a thing for you, you'll probably like it. It's often best read aloud if you can decipher my adolescent handwriting. But otherwise, I'm so excited about Letters to Meth, and like, anyone who has lived experience of meth who wants to access it definitely can reach out. Like, I'm not afraid to give my email, like javalelly@gmail.com. Hit me up and we'll find a way to get it to you. If you don't have that lived experience, we'll accept like some donations towards reprinting or something. I got to work that out, but I'm really proud of Letters to Meth. I think it's really beautiful, and I'm really grateful to the many, many, many community members who contributed for sharing that with me and with everyone.
Yeah, it's so good.
In terms of the next place, will be, I'm going to be at Canzine Saskatoon on November 23rd, which is at the library in Saskatoon. But besides that, I'm not sure. Are you going to be anywhere? Or do you have any other zines you want to shout out from our very stacked table?
I mean, I think I'm just going to say that, like, I'm just going to plug my little zine called Pink Information. That awesome. It took years. Like, it's been a multi-year project. It's a lot of time that went into like interviewing all these folks and building relationships and transcribing it and then making maps and like putting them onto business cards. It's like a really time intensive project.
It's very beautiful.
Thanks. And I am thankful that all of these older queer guys trust me with their stories. And I think that that's just a really meaningful addition. If you want to reach out, but honestly, the thing I check most is my Twitter. So, plug for followers. You can find me at twitter.com/@ Eric, ERIC _ Levitt, LEVITT.
That would be great. I don't have Twitter, but I'm on the Instas. It's Dutch Lanvin, DutchLanvin, but it's mostly my ballroom life and me being fabulous in that way.
But so people should know that.
Yeah, you can totally find me there.
No, like, people should know those things.
Yeah.
Thanks. You're an important person who does many things.
You're like, wow. Listen, find y'all a collaborator or friend like Eric, or like people that you admire and praise constantly, because that's what Eric and I do to each other, and it feels really good.
So great.
And also, likewise to you, so it's been really fun.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. As always, you can tune into From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM in the Kingston area, or you can find the podcast version online by searching for From Embers wherever you find your podcasts. And you can drop us a line at fromembers@riseup.net. See you next week.